We have so much to catch up about, but there's one main topic that I really think we need to address.
Is it the fact that I did a viral tweet?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, like, where, like, it was, how long ago was that? It feels like a million years ago in internet years.
Yeah, it was a few weeks ago at this point, which is a long time. Although, yeah, it's still doing its thing, man.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask. Is like, is it over yet?
No. Yeah, so it was 3 weeks ago, about. Oh. And yeah, I mean, I got another tweet about it 53 minutes ago and a few retweets and likes since then. So I think that it's just going to keep trickling on into eternity, it feels like, at this point.
So what's the view count on the video?
The view count is a good segue into explaining the story behind it, which is that I came back on Twitter, as anyone who has listened to the show knows. And one of the things that I felt was important to me coming back to Twitter was I wanted to be more on it. Like, I wanted to be interacting with people, not just lurking in the background. And so I thought, you know what? If something seems cool to me, I want to share it and I want to talk to people about it, because it's no fun keeping it all for myself. The whole thing that I care about on the internet is community. So time to share things. I found this video online of this guy who went to a restaurant where it was like a sushi conveyor belt, which I thought people knew were things, but this tweet has led me to believe that many people have never heard of that and are very confused at the concept. And he put a GoPro on that conveyor belt and just let it go around the restaurant and record people who were eating their meals. And it's just this little slice of life video that is really charming. And so I added some music to it, because all that was happening was really badly muffled GoPro audio clinking restaurant sounds. And I uploaded it to my Twitter. And now it has 7.4 million views.
Mad. Wow.
Over 2,000 replies, 154,000 retweets, and 461,000 likes. And it was a lot. And it was kind of a weird thing for me, because it was pretty close to right when I had kind of come back to Twitter. So it was like 5 months of me not using the service to, okay, I'm back, post that tweet, and then, oh, this is a whole different level of social networking that I've never experienced before, the effect of actually going viral. So yeah, I did that, and it was a real weird thing.
What does that mean to you, that something that you put a little bit of time and effort into and put up as just one of your tweets turned into something like that?
It's a part of these social networks now, right? That, like, things just kind of explode. And that's the whole fun of the check out my SoundCloud after tweet, which I got to do, which was part of the charm of the whole thing.
Yeah. Hi, everybody, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This was my SoundCloud, this very podcast. But it's so clear that, you know, it's people that are just living normal lives, tweeting to their 200 followers that sometimes have these viral things. And then they're just like, wait, don't leave. Don't go away. Wait, can I do something good with this more than this weird joke that I made that, you know, went crazy? Mm. And so it didn't really, like, surprise me that it happened, because things that are good that get attention get more attention, and these social networks that really want to capture your attention are good at sending people or sending items that capture attention to other people. So it's like this weird snowball effect that happens all the time now, and I just happened to be the person that it happened for that day. But I mean, it was fun. Like, it was a good time. And it weirdly changed my Twitter usage afterwards, because Twitter seems to think I'm an influencer now. And my tweets get a lot more traction than they did beforehand, so I'm not really complaining about it. All of that said, I totally feel like it was just a weird fluke. Like, I can't really take any credit for it, nor can I really draw any massive conclusions from it. Hmm. There's definitely no, like, playbook of how to make a thing go viral. It's totally random. And in fact, a few days before I posted that, I spent way more time on something else. I can't even recall what it was now, but I spent way more time making something. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. I think people will like it. And of course, nobody cared. And it just, you know, went out into the void. And then Twitter moved on.
something that struck me about that experience, and it's funny that you described it as a day because it was totally like a week of of like sustained maximum attention is how it felt, you know, like, or at least like 3 or 4 days before it, you know, like the Patton Oswalt retweet came on like day three, yeah, right? So like the momentum was so sustained for such a long time that we just were like checking in about like, hey, how's it doing now? Oh, it's getting faster now, you know, like it was a much longer and more sustained ride than anything I had ever seen behind the scenes of on the internet. But something that struck me about it is that it didn't conflict at all. Nothing that you did, nothing about the video conflicted at all with the sort of good faith philosophy that we had just set as our intention for coming back on Twitter. You know, it's almost like a perfect example of something pure and good and not at all trolly or offensive, and having that kind of thing be so popular. I mean, there's a level on which that's not surprising either. Like, I'm sure people are thirsting for something positive and uncomplicated to like, you know, in the sea of misery that is most of what seems to go viral. But I'm really interested in these effects. I mean, I'm interested in the things we could glean, if anything, about how Twitter accelerates content.
Yeah,
maybe it's safe to at least conjecture about the possibility that the platform itself wants more positive content out there.
Well, let me say something about that. I actually have two things to say in regards to good faith / bad faith, but I personally believe that that video is extremely # good faith Twitter. Not everyone agrees with me about that. Mm. And actually, I feel as if that might be part of the reason that it was so successful, was because there was this interesting area of controversy around it. Because
oh, interesting.
A decent amount of the replies that I got for this video, which I thought was pretty innocuous and just pleasant, were people saying, this is a horrible, horrible invasion of privacy. None of these people being filmed consented to it, which I have to agree that they didn't consent to it. And if they didn't want to be shown, I did now show them to 7.4 million people. So, you know, that's a real thing. Nobody was doing anything besides eating sushi, so it didn't seem too worrisome to me. And a lot of them look into the camera, wave, and get really happy about it.
Right. Like, that's consent to me.
Yeah, it seems pretty clear. And then also, this is disgustingly unsanitary, which I don't really personally understand.
Come on, internet.
Yeah, I haven't tried to interact with anybody who said that, because I really had no interest in that. That is very bad faith Twitter, right? Like, interacting with the people who are mad and mean. But like, it's a conveyor belt, you know? It was a camera on a conveyor belt. All the food is on plates. I don't really know why it's unsanitary.
I think we could leave that one alone. But the consent issue is pretty interesting. And I think I also want to add in the complicating factor of like, somebody else shot this video. And that guy, you know, like, didn't some of this heat come from the people who had already been mad at him?
Yes. So that's the second part. And that was actually something I wanted to ask you about, my journalist friend, because I have always tried to adhere to good journalism rules, but I'm not a journalist, so I don't really know exactly what that means. But I did post this video without directly linking to the original video. I did an immediate Twitter thread, so the second tweet was the YouTube video. Mm-hmm. But I took the video, I uploaded it to my own Twitter, and I posted it there. And I know that if I would have said, this is a really great video, check it out, and I had a YouTube link, it would have got one like,
yep,
and nobody would have ever cared again. So the reason that I did this was so people could see it, and I did share the person. That person, whether or not that person is a good or bad person, is a story for another day. So a lot of people do not seem to enjoy the material he's putting out into the world, and I have not gone down the rabbit hole of watching other YouTube videos of his. So, yes. So, but and here's the interesting thing to me is all of these people who were saying, well, not all of these people, but a lot of these people who were saying this is a horrible invasion of privacy were doing so by quote tweeting the video and resharing it and adding their comment to it.
Uh-huh.
So, of course, there were some people that just replied to me and said, this sucks. But a lot of people told the world that it sucks by sharing it with their followers, which is really interesting, right?
To me, that's the clearest possible indication of bad faith.
Yeah.
That, like, the quote tweet is the internationally recognized format for the dunk tweet. That, like, the thing that they're doing is not actually criticizing you. The thing that they're doing is performing
yes.
moral superiority at your expense.
So weirdly, I feel like my good faith tweet was covertly put out into the world because it also worked as a bad faith tweet.
Yeah, so that's very interesting.
A lot because it wasn't half and half. I would say that it was maybe 70-30. I don't know exactly, but it felt like the majority of people were really positive and happy to see this video, but a decent chunk of people did not enjoy it. And I wonder, would it have had the same sort of trajectory if it would have been purely good and no one could figure out a way to be mad at it? It's like, do you have to have something that people can be mad at? Or maybe another way of saying it is, will just everybody always be mad at anything that gets a lot of attention generated to it? Like, is that just part of how it works now?
And to what extent is it an algorithm thing? Because I feel like it's probably, I don't know this for a fact about Twitter's algorithm, but I've certainly seen on other sites actively surface controversial posts. I think Google Plus made a big deal about this too, that when Google Plus was rolling out, it was really all about showing people how content spreads. Mm-hmm. Do you remember?
Yeah.
It had like real-time bubbles that you could watch, and there were different ways to filter it, and one of the ways was controversial, where like when something's very polarizing, it generates a lot of interest, and then the algorithm notices that and wants to amplify it because it's got a lot of interest because there's fighting going on. And like that sounds like a recipe for disaster in a lot of cases. And it's really hard to know these days, like what Twitter's optimizing for. And the sense that I'm getting, because Twitter's doing tons of press these days. They're doing so much press about like their philosophy and their direction, their near-term direction that they want to go in for the platform. It feels like Twitter in particular is constantly monkeying around with what the algorithm is. Like, it feels like there's probably people who sit there all day adjusting what people see.
It does feel that way, yeah.
And like, it wouldn't surprise me to know that the reason that your tweet went viral is because someone at Twitter saw it and pushed a button that put it into another category.
To me, it feels like that would be like, send this as a so-and-so liked this tweet thing. Like,
right,
I don't
sure.
know how those work, but that can't possibly just be every tweet that anyone likes can possibly get surfaced there.
And yeah, and it's like, when do those pop up? Like it's totally mysterious when you get those kinds of notifications and tweets.
And I mean, that's the case now, is when I post a video or something, I get a lot of replies from people that just aren't following me.
Right.
So it must mean that I am now, and actually people have screenshotted and sent to me tweets that they get that it doesn't even say so-and-so liked this. It says so-and-so follows this person uh-huh. and sends a tweet of mine. And often that person is Barack Obama, which I really appreciate. Back in the campaigning days when that account was following everybody,
yeah.
I got a follow from good old Barack Obama. And so, yeah, that's a way that Twitter is surfacing my tweets for random people is like, you know, basically saying Barack Obama trusts this guy. Maybe he'll like it.
And like, that's not the kind of thing that can escape the notice of managers at Twitter, that like
right.
the Barack Obama account follows how many hundred thousand people, and like that's being used as a signal. Like that totally seems like the kind of thing that they would intentionally use to amplify tweets.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. So I want to go back to this attribution angle.
Yeah, right.
Because I'm curious to know what your perspective is. So I actually sent you a link to the tweet when it was in its nascent phase and had like 50 likes or something, you know?
Yeah.
Like the night of, I was like, wow, this got some likes and now I'm happy. Like that makes me feel satisfied. And then, you know, the next day the ball really started rolling.
I think you might've sent me one more that was like, oh wow, there's 100 now.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the next day it was like, what's happening?
I mean, what was your opinion of it? Like, did you think that it was interesting? Did you watch it?
I think I only watched a few seconds of it for the first day or so. Like when you first sent it to me, I like saw what it was and I was like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. People like, you know, happy videos. Like right. That's great. Like I was aware that you hadn't made the video. You've asked for my journalistic opinion on the IP issues here. Strictly speaking, it was not cool to do that. You have to have the creator's explicit permission to re-upload a video of his. That's why all those hilarious threads happen when like somebody takes a phone video of a tornado.
Yeah.
And then like every journalist in America sends them the exact same message.
It's like, great video. Can we use this?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So like the reason there's somebody who's just got to sit there all day and do that because that's how the news networks can like cut all their employed camera people and still get footage. But obviously that's something that happens all day long a million times. Mm-hmm. Is like people reposting other people's content, and then like the next rung down of etiquette, like that's the law. And so then the next rung down is like what is proper and attribution of content of somebody else's content is always the courteous thing to do.
Right. And it's something as an internet person, I know, like I run the Instagram account for Evergreen, the coffee shop I own. And every time that I post a photo, I tag and like say who took the photo, mm-hmm. you know, in the caption. And I don't expressly ask them because most times that people take a photo of my coffee shop, post a photo of it online and tag me, they are very happy for me to reshare that photo.
Sure.
But I would never, ever, ever just take their photo and not give them credit. And
right.
And I tried to do that in this by adding the link to their original source in the second tweet. Mm-hmm. But that was not enough for most people. They thought that I should have added it in the first thing and that I was trying to like steal his views or something, mm-hmm. Which I, you know, I wasn't intending. I was intending to create the best optimal experience for this video.
Right. Which it should be said you did by also adding music and making it a better video, not just by taking his and putting it on your account.
Yeah, that's true. Which by the way, to even give a little more backstory, I did this at the gym. Like I was at a squat rack and I downloaded the Video Leap app, which is this great video editing app for the iPhone. And I downloaded the YouTube video with a shortcut and I downloaded the song that I found with a shortcut. And then I put them together in Video Leap and I exported it and uploaded it to Twitter without thinking about it. It was just like, oh, this is a really cool way for me to do that thing I want to do really quick. Let's try it out. Oh, this worked. Oh, let's post it. You know, like it was that type of experience.
So the song was also something that you, expropriated from another creator.
And interestingly enough, just to be fully honest, that was the one that I felt worse about at the end of the day. Uh-huh. Because I was like, oh man, I didn't even think to figure out where that song came from because it was in like an hour-long YouTube video that didn't even give proper credit.
Right.
And so somebody actually like tweeted the person. They figured out what the song was and like tweeted them. And they were actually like, oh, so cool. Like they didn't have any problem with it at all. Yeah. But then I felt bad. Like, oh no, I wish I could have sent people, and I actually sent many, many tweets. Anytime that anyone would say, what's this song? I would like properly credit that person and send a tweet just to that person saying exactly what it was because I felt really guilty about that. So yes, it was.
That was very good of you.
It was two people's stuff. And yeah, so I mean, this is the funny thing is I know that I didn't do this the quote unquote right way, but I am not ABC Action News Channel 7.
Nor were you trying in any way to be.
I am Drew Kaufman, Twitter user, God knows what, right? And so it's like there's a different set of rules that people play by. And I honestly feel like anybody who plays by the right rules, the quote unquote like good real rules, gets punished.
Right.
Because if you do all of those things, you are setting yourself up to be ignored.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it was a very interesting feeling to watch people get really mad at the way that I had done that. But if I could go back and do it again, besides crediting the art, the musician quicker, there's nothing I really would have changed.
Hi, Internet friends. It's John here. Internet Friends is brought to you by my work at Ablaze Interactions, where I solve communication problems for clients who work to repair our world. I can help with information architecture to transform your website, content strategy to tell the right story and reach the right audience, and writing and editing to find the authentic voice of your company or organization, your product, or your idea. Ablaze Interactions has consulted for world-renowned events, political candidates, law firms, nonprofits, and great apps on the App Store. Light up your ideas. Go to ablaze.co and let me know if you're interested in working together. This truism about everything being a remix, it's people doing exactly what you did. Going out shooting a video and then composing an original piano soundtrack for it is hard. So, like, somebody did shoot the video, but, you know, he didn't go back and put a soundtrack on it after that.
And he also, by the way, like, was very successful with that video.
Oh, so he does have a views in the millions for this video?
If not millions, then, like, you know, a very, very high number. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's a lot. It's not 7.4 million, but it's a lot.
But that actually makes me feel a lot better about the multiplier that you got, because he succeeded as much as he could with the video as good as it was, and then you made it better, and you succeeded that much more. It's not like it's a zero-sum game where, like, you know, you stole attention from him. But if it had been this obscure thing that you had plucked out, that it just would have felt different. I'm not sure if it is different or not.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that before, that if it was something that had had, like, three views that I found and then did this, and then I looked back and saw that there was really no gain for that person, I think I would have felt sad about that. Mm-hmm. And that's not the experience that this was, in that the link that I had to the original YouTube video had thousands and thousands and thousands of clicks through from Twitter. Mm-hmm. And the original video had already had a lot of views. And he's a successful YouTuber. He has lots of followers on YouTube. So, yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. And I do wonder if a lot of people who said, like, this is stolen, or this is, you know, not your content, weren't really thinking about it and did just think that it was some poor soul that I had, like, ripped off and done nothing to change it. And, you know, I don't really know. That's a That's a curious thing. And there's no really good way of, like, explaining that, nor is there a really clear line, a boundary line of, like, when it's acceptable and when it isn't. But it does feel different to me.
Yeah.
It feels very different, the fact that he was already successful on his own.
Then there's, of course, the idea that I think a lot of us have, I mean, I've made work out of it at various times. Like, the idea that curation is creative in nature, that, like, you know, seeing something and knowing that it's good, and then choosing it out of the infinite number of things to be the thing that you amplify, like, does have a sort of editorial quality to it. And, like, there's something I can point to in that tweet of, and that, like, not just the video, but the thing you wrote in the tweet, that feels completely consistent with your taste, you know, like it was original to you in some way. The choice to see it, the choice to share it, you know, the choice to celebrate it the way that you did. Like, there are things, personal creative things that you added to it. And the thing before about, you know, original creatives and, like, how hard it is, that I'm trying to draw attention to, is kind of a photographer's dilemma, right? Like, taking a picture of something that's already there in the world is closer to this kind of thing than, like, painting a picture out of nowhere, right? It's still curating.
Yeah.
To, like, go through the world with these smartphones and various sensors on board and capture stuff out of the environment and turn it into our stream of whatever it is. That makes it feel more natural to do what you did to create this video, because it's not really, it's like another instance of the same thing.
Yeah.
As pointing your camera at something.
When you said the word curation, one of the things that it made me think of too, that I think is something that I also hadn't really considered in the, like, how do I feel taking this thing and resharing it, is the fact that this was an old video. I don't think I would ever have done anything like this with something that was brand new. that would feel wrong to me, because it feels mm-hmm. like that is something that somebody is posting in that moment. And the only thing to do is to like broadcast that and not like try to reshare it and broadcast my own thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like part of curation and like what I like is when I find something that's older and has obviously been either forgotten or is like past its point where it was getting eyeballs, and then bringing it back to people's attention. This conversation is just making me think about all of the things that intuitively felt right to me. It's making me think about what would intuitively feel wrong. And I hadn't really considered that until this moment, because anything that I've shared, I've only shared because it felt right. I think that I'm definitely somebody who is very like input oriented. I've always known that I'm not really the type of artist that has a good go at having a blank canvas in front of me and just starting and creating something. Mm-hmm. That's why I was drawn to photography. That's why I like working with partners and having collaborators. And a podcast is a great example of this. Like, the reason that I feel really comfortable having this artistic venue is because I can have a conversation with you. And if I didn't, I would be so uncomfortable trying to do a podcast of any length where it's just me talking to a microphone alone. But that's somebody's skill. There's plenty of people that do that.
I did like 75 podcast episodes last year of just myself talking,
which I would never do. I just wouldn't.
Well, I wouldn't do it now anymore either, but I still have it in me.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so because I know that I am a very input-oriented person, I am drawn to that idea of curation. That is sort of what I've been seeing my Twitter as. Mm-hmm. There were like a few things that I said to people that I cared about when I came back on Twitter. Like, one of them being, I want to share more. One of them being, I want to start doing videos because I really miss editing videos. It's something I don't have in my life right now.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, good thing I said these things before I did this, because now it would just look purely like I'm trying to, you know, repeat the thing that was successful that one time. And also, like, you see that I wasn't just doing this for no reason or the intent to go viral, but this was like the thing that was that I was craving in my life. And, you know, you have had a really interesting Twitter account that I followed for so long now, which is that John is Reading account. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, it used to have my normal standard Ablaze username when I didn't have any other Twitter account.
And that is, that's this really interesting account that you've been maintaining for a long time at this point, where when you read articles online, you click this button and then it gets tweeted by this bot that exists. And is that Reading AM? Is that what it's called?
Not anymore. Oh. That is where it came from. Uh-huh. And it used to be just a straight up integration with this great indie service called reading.am. And it was a community. I mean, it might still be going on. It became too limiting. The format became too limiting to me. And I realized that I could expand it in ways that I found much more compelling and like customize the tweet content and stuff. What I really wanted to do was create topics. And I figured out what using Pinboard, which I was already also using as my own personal bookmarking. Pinboard has RSS feeds on your account. So like tags have their own RSS feed. So it was very easy for me to set up a bunch of different triggers for just using Pinboard the way I already did to keep track of the stuff I was reading, to just send off tweets as exhaust from my normal reading habits.
You mentioned Pinboard, which, if people don't know, it is this pretty ridiculously overpowered way to catalog everything you've ever done online.
Well, catalog anything you want, I would say.
Yes, that's true. And you've been doing it meticulously for years and years and years. And I have tried to do that in my own way. I have used Pinboard. I've used Reading AM. I've done these things because it fascinates me. I love being able to like have a real sense of history with what I do. And I've just realized that that's not the kind of person that I am, in the sense of that doesn't, like, I don't stick with that for long enough for it to be meaningful. But what I can do is what I'm doing right now. And this is something that I've done forever in just like iMessage threads. And now I'm turning Twitter into the place that this all goes, which is like sharing something, sharing a video or sharing a link or sharing some text, and like just adding something little to it that is like the thing that matters the most to me, mm-hmm. with people that I care about. And so I just decided that I'm going to do that on Twitter. And it was funny because if you would go back through my Twitter in the months and years before this new resurgence of me using the network, you would see that my desire to like play by the rules was really high. Hmm. Like I don't think I would have ever done the things that I'm doing now in the sense of like downloading videos and uploading them and doing different things like that, because I was trying really, really hard to do it the right way. But what I just realized is, one, that right way wasn't really working, and two, that right way just wasn't fun. And that might not be like good. Like, I'm fully okay with that not being good, but I'm just recognizing that there is a way for me to really, really enjoy my time on the social network that I'm clearly going to spend a decent chunk of my day in, and this is the way that it has to be.
You're using your curatorial abilities to their fullest extent now.
And to be like fully truthful, what I think I'm also doing is using my like video editing skills, which is
sure
not like massively overpowered, but it is one of those weird things that the whole world doesn't have, so it does set me slightly apart. It's like something that I can offer people that they may not have done on their own.
Yes.
And I think that is like a weirdly powerful thing when it comes to social networks, is thinking like, wait, what can I do that most people can't? And, you know, editing a video and uploading it and making it cool and vibey is something that I'm particularly good at in these short bursts.
You just nailed something that I've been thinking about for a month since I started my job at Inside, which is the line or the difference, whatever it might be, between curating and editing. When is a curator an editor, and when is an editor a curator, and is there even a difference? Mm. And if not, why use those words? Mm. And so the reason it came up for me in the first place was that curator kept being the word that other Inside newsletter people were using for their role. Like there are editors mm. who are our editors, who we turn our newsletters into, and they edit the, you know, the English in our newsletters. And so what does that make the people who create the newsletters? Does it make them writers? We do write original copy, but it's often summary with maybe a tiny bit of editorial. Mainly what we do, though, is collect stuff from around the internet mm-hmm. that fits into our daily issue. So a lot of people were using the word curator, but I immediately used the word editor in my signature and my bio, and even in the bio in the newsletter, because first of all, that's been my title for a long time. You know, like that is what my job is called. And like, I don't think that it is just curation.
Right.
It's curation followed by editing, which is what you're describing. And what I mean by that is, it's not just finding stuff and sticking it up there. It's not just hitting the reblog button. It's explaining why it's important, and maybe even editing out the parts that aren't as important.
Which was, in this case, by the way, the extra minute of video in the original thing where it like went back into the kitchen, and then a really confused staff person was like looking at the GoPro and then has to go find his boss, and then it sits in like a container for a full 45 seconds until someone else comes and they find the original guy and give it back to him. And, you know, although that sounds kind of thrilling, it's very boring. So that part got cut.
Well, I'm sure it was hilarious for the guy whose camera it was.
Right.
But yes. Like, it wasn't important to millions of people who watched your version. And so that's this line between curation and editing. Like, I guess I've answered my own question. Like, there's definitely a line, and editing is a more technical skill, and it's a more artistic skill. And so you are adding, you reframed what I said in a way that I think is extremely apt. You are adding your uniquely honed skills as an editor to the stuff that you are curating that is susceptible to your editing, and thereby making good stuff now. And it's good stuff with like a capital G and a capital S, because it's not just like stuff that works on the internet. It's stuff that you're enjoying, that you're applying yourself to. And like that. So, and you know, I guess my thing that I do on the internet that I am good at and naturally, and tons of people can't do or don't do, is read a million articles a day.
And then select the ones that are actually noteworthy.
That's where I'm applying my editing skills. Uh-huh. And that's why taking a job editing a newsletter with 10 Apple news items a day in it was like, It's so fun that I don't care how little it pays, you know, like, cause I wasn't getting paid to do it before.
And you were doing it anyways. Yes, exactly.
Right. So, and like, I wasn't getting to share my thoughts with anybody except you on days that there are Apple events. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like this is a win-win for everybody. And that is because I am a practiced editor at it. Like, that's why people are subscribed. So it's really interesting to think about editors as artists. And like, there are some media where it's obvious, you know, like some, like film editors get Oscars.
Right.
I wonder if we are in an ascendant era for editors. Editors are the only way that we can get anything good out of this fire hose on any given day.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big part of it. And like, I think that I have always really enjoyed following people who have overwhelmingly positive and interesting and insightful feeds. Like, that's why I liked Twitter in the first place, was not just because of people saying funny things or cool things or interesting things, but people sharing things of like real substance that I found so fascinating. And as an input oriented person, I mean, Twitter is like the place to be, right?
Yeah.
Because if I can follow 100 people that are all sharing incredible, fascinating stuff of substance, I'm so happy. And the reason that we have had so many conversations like being woeful and mournful about the state of Twitter is because I slowly watched those people who had been sharing nothing but beautiful, powerful, substantial material with me starting to become bitter and angry and sad and worried and anxious. And I could feel the change that the platform was going through. And, you know, there's so much that has been written and talked about in regards to the fact that, of course, it's because these networks are much better at sharing that kind of material than they are with the good stuff. But like, you know, that's just been such a bummer. And since I've come back, there have been quite a few people who I've followed because I just really appreciate the kind of things that they're doing that I have pretty quickly unfollowed because the things that they're actually talking about are not the work that they're doing or the things that they're interacting with in the world that are positive, but instead just talking about the sad things, the bad things. And, you know, I'm not in control of those people, so they can do whatever they want, but I'm not going to follow that. That's not what I'm going to spend my days doing. And so I want to create the kinds of material that I would want to read and watch and listen to, which is stuff that makes me happy and fascinated and curious and interesting. And like, that's what I've been doing. And the things that I followed up this viral tweet with, I feel like have all been in a similar space than that. It's me learning about old typewriters that I find really fascinating. It's me making little weird edits of like Zelda video game footage and putting lo-fi music on top of it just because I think it's really cool. And like, that's what I want to listen to that day. Mm-hmm. So guess what? Maybe other people want to listen to it too. And guess what? They do, you know? So it's just been fun because I've really found an interesting subset of people who I didn't really know I shared a lot in common with that I'm finding that commonality with through the kinds of things that I'm sharing. And of course, I am not the one that is 100% responsible for making that material in the first place, which again, is not necessarily anything like brand new / stolen. I feel even less bad reposting footage of like The Legend of Zelda from the N64 than I do this sushi guy's footage, right? Like, you know,
right.
I don't really feel like there's a victim.
You paid Nintendo at one point.
I did. I sure did. So yeah, it's been really good. Like, I've enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed that feeling of curation that I have been excited about for 10 years now. And I feel like it's taking a different turn now. And it is something that is more into the editorial world than it's ever been before.
Who would have thought that the solution to our problems on Twitter not getting the kind of input we wanted would be just to start making output,
yeah,
and then celebrating,
yeah,
that's happening and that people are liking it.
Totally. Yeah,
I mean, it's happening for me too. It's not happening anywhere near the same scale as it's happening for you, but like, I've come back on Twitter at the same time as I've started making stuff, curating and editing stuff again. Mm-hmm. And like, that's working out. People are reading it and enjoying it and telling me, and that is making it all worth it. I mean, I'm still churning a lot on my following side too. That's something I wanted to ask you, is like, how, like, are you, is this solving your problem with, or like, do you, like, as an input oriented person, like, are you still craving that as much, like, or have you let go of it because you're having fun anyway?
We'll see how this plays out over time. And there's one side of me that thinks that I'm going to be dealing with likes and retweets of this sushi video into eternity. But then there's another part of me that feels like at any moment it could just shut off, like, completely and be done, you know? And I'm curious to know what that tail, that long tail, is like. And also if that's like having an effect on the things that I'm tweeting right now. Like, will there be a time where the algorithm favors me less than it does right now? I really don't know. But what I do know is that anytime I post anything now, I get a handful of replies and a handful of retweets and a bunch of likes. And the metric that I care about there is the replies. Like, that's what makes me interested. And the fact that I now can positively know that when I'm sharing something, it's not going out into a void of nothingness, but instead like to people, it makes me happy. And so I'm not looking for another video that has 7.4 million views, but I do want to know when I made a thing, somebody saw it and was happy. Mm-hmm. And like, that's happening now. So that makes me feel good. And, you know, I think there is a funny parallel with the stuff that you're making, because obviously you know that the emails that you are writing are getting read by people. So we both kind of feel, I think, that reality of that very real material relationship between the stuff that we're making and the people that are viewing it, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of the fun part about doing email. And like, I got used to this at you know, one of my biggest responsibilities at Burning Man was an email. And that there was just so much else going on that I never really got to enjoy the replies to that email that much. But this is different. And also the audience is a lot smaller. But so it's not like I'm drowning in nonsense replies every time I send a message. And that has actually really helped. But the fact that email is a publication medium now. It's as much of a publication medium as it is a communication medium. But the fact that it is in essence a communication medium makes it such a natural way to start a conversation by creating something, because I create something and I send it and it's effectively a message. Mm. And so I get replies to messages every day. And some of them have been critical, but all of the critical ones that I've gotten have been sort of format criticisms, you know, like, you know, I wish you wouldn't write so many words, just like send me links, you know, like, you know, whatever, like, well, I'll work that out with you. I'll write six fewer words in my 50 word blurb next time, I promise. But like the most of them have been, I wonder if you saw this, like, have you covered today at Apple classes yet? I just did one. It was really fun. And what I said to that person was, if you do another one, take pictures with your phone and write 50 words about it and send it to me, and I will put your post in the newsletter. Mm,
that's cool.
And the dude freaked out. He was like, he didn't know that was possible. So like, it's similar to Twitter in a certain way, because they're kind of both messaging mediums that have been turned in that are now being used as professional publication mediums. And like, the, you know, Twitter was created around the SMS message, and now it's like something that 7 million people will watch a video on. I think we're choosing well, you and I, as people who are communicators, who are looking essentially, like, fundamentally for relationships with people online. We have chosen the right media because we're using media that are just as good at publishing and communicating in the ways that we are suited to. Mm. Yeah. And it's really cool that it's working.
Hello, internet friends. It's Drew, and I want to tell you about Keyhouse. There's a quote from Kurt Vonnegut that I read tucked away in an essay he wrote about the seasons, where he said that he thought that the idea of four seasons was a lie. Instead, we should have six. Fall doesn't move to winter, and winter doesn't move to spring. Instead, he thought the season should be like so. Summer, fall, locking, winter, unlocking, and spring. I believe there's a beautiful poetry to the idea that creation itself requires a time of unlocking before anything of substance can bloom. And perhaps you're listening to this message right now, stuck between what you're doing and what you want to do for the rest of your life, realizing that you might be in that cruel season of unlocking too. Find your own space for unlocking. Go to Keyhouse, KEYHOU.SE, and let's find the key. I want to tell you a parable of good Twitter and bad Twitter.
Mm.
At the same time that my little happy sushi tweet went viral, so too did another tweet that had quite a following. That was this thread that started with a tweet that said something along the lines of, "Do you want to hear a story about the time that I accidentally took a brick of heroin from Los Angeles to Seattle?"
I knew that thing was fake. I mean, like, I the first time I read it, I didn't go, "That's fake." I went, "This sucks too much to be this popular."
Yeah. So if you missed it, first of all, good, and I'm sorry that I'm going to share it with you now, but it's for the benefit of this story. But this person posted this very long Twitter thread where basically they detailed out this entire journey they took, where they bought this van and they took it around and they did some drugs, and then they opened the hood and they found this big block of heroin, and then they decided to sell it. But then this guy that used to own the van called them, and then they found out that it was his and he was in a gang, and then they decided that they were going to pull one over on him. And then they like faked a new fake brick of heroin and put it in the car and sold it back to him. And he was so happy until he left. And, you know, it's like just this annoying. It's honestly just, I'm getting annoyed at myself for telling this entire story.
You have to get to the happy ending, which is the happy ending is the gang member of a different race than the teller of the story is in prison now. So it's okay to tell this story publicly because he's not in danger from the person of color who he victimized in the story.
Yes. It sucked. It sucked so bad. And a lot of people liked it a lot. And I mean, I probably saw 6 or 7 like versions of "read this now" in my Twitter timeline. And it was an interesting ride for the guy who did that, because he shot up to stardom. He maintained that it was a real story for a long time. He started telling everyone that Hollywood producers were reaching out to him to turn his tweet thread into a movie. And then like 1 or 2 days later, as it kept getting press, the press started changing from "check out this guy's crazy story" to "this guy stole heroin from notorious gang MS-13, which kind of changed the environment for him, I think, a little bit. And then he started not talking about how he was really excited to have producers talking with him about making his tweets into a movie, but saying that he started feeling very scared and he felt like his life was being threatened and that he needed to move immediately. And I mean, it honestly gets so much messier from there. Like, there's a few twists and turns that I didn't anticipate it taking. He eventually deleted his account, but you will be not so surprised to hear that he is back on the social network now.
Oh, I am surprised.
Oh, really?
To hear that, actually.
Oh, no, no, I'm not surprised at all.
Well, he's clearly an addict.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, people thought, oh, wow, he lost all his followers because he had, you know, 50,000 followers or 20,000 followers or something. But no, of course, he was able to unsuspend his account and go right back to, you know, where everything had left off again. But I don't know. It just felt very interesting to me.
Well, wait. He made it up.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Of course. That's oh, you said it, and I forgot to tell it to the audience, because of course it seemed very clear. It was a not real story that he stupidly used a real gang name for, which makes no sense at all. If you're going to make up a whole story, you might as well just make up a new gang for it. Like, that's part of the fun, right? But no, he had to use notorious Mexican MS-13 gang to, I guess, make it feel more real or something like that.
Gritty.
Yes, exactly. I made it up and I'm so sorry, but people are still going to kill me because I disrespected their gang and blah, 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 blah. It sucked. And that was weird to watch the thing that I had made that felt very, to me at least, wholesome and pleasant and happy to be kind of competing for people's attention, or maybe not competing, going side by side with this thing that felt like the complete opposite of the kinds of things that I care about and I'm interested in. Does that make sense? Like that weird juxtaposition?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've totally spaced on the fact that it happened at the same time because of the weird time vortex that Twitter takes place in.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's really interesting. And like I said earlier, I don't think it's a zero-sum thing. That's not how Twitter works. Mm-mm. Twitter is for input-oriented people, as you said earlier. Like, people are seeking novelty at all times. And so everybody saw both of those tweets that day. And yours helped people, and his didn't. And it came back to him, I guess, is the thing. This might not be like a nihilistic enough take for an internet take, but we can at least take solace in the fact that there's like some karma involved in doing it his way. And the contrast to that I think makes it even more true is the little things that you did that broke the rules. That like you righted those wrong. Like you communicated with the guy who made the video, didn't you?
Yeah.
At one point,
yeah. And he seemed pretty okay. He seemed a little sad at first, and then okay with it once he realized that I wasn't being nefarious in any way.
Yeah. So like your karma is clear because what you were doing was in the interest of everyone, and this dude's karma is destroyed right. Because he was doing it only in the interest of himself.
It kind of came back to mind a couple of days ago because I saw somebody tweet something that like I feel like a lot of people agree with, which was something along the lines of every day the internet picks a hero and a villain and you just hope that neither one's you. And I get the sentiment behind that because going viral is like a dangerous game, right? Like you can't control it. There was nothing that I could have done once it reached a certain point to get it back in the bottle. It makes me always think of Flappy Bird. Do you remember Flappy Bird?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
He literally deleted the game from the App Store because that was the only way he could figure out how to put the genie back in the bottle. The only thing that you can do is scorched earth tactics. Nothing else will do. And so I get that and I understand, but at the same time, it's like, I think that you can just be good faith.
Mm.
I don't think that there's anything that is bad that can come out of being good faith. Will everyone agree with you? Of course not. Will everyone be on your side? Absolutely not. That's not how the internet works, and that's not how the world has ever worked. Mm-hmm. But I feel completely, completely fine being a part of good faith Twitter, and I hope that I get picked as a user of good faith Twitter again and again and again.
I do just want to briefly say that like good faith is hard to have,
mm-hmm.
you know, like wouldn't that be like a pretty appropriate summary of like Christianity?
Yeah.
Like it's not easy to have good faith. And like the scorched earth thing that you were just saying, like the effect of the hero and the villain dynamic on the internet every day, it's this massive amplifying effect. I wrote about this back at ReadWrite with regard to crowdfunding, as crowdfunding was sort of ascendant as like a dominant economic model at that time, like 2011, 2012, 2013, I wrote a lot about the disproportionate effects of it, where like something really, really awesome would come up and it just wouldn't get the traction. And then like something completely inane would happen and get $10 million, you know? And like, that's the story. That was at the same time that the Flappy Bird phenomenon happened too. For people who don't remember, one dude in Vietnam, like a young guy, made a game that he intentionally made as like the hardest, like an impossible iPhone game. Like that was the reason he made it. And he just like got the right mix of press to the point where it was like the most popular app in the store. And I think I remember reading that he was making $900,000 a day at the time that he pulled it off the store or something like that. Like, or maybe it was a month. Like that's too much money for it to be a day, but like, that's like how much money Apple made on the App Store that day. It was like an amount of money that he could have like, that like would have doubled the GDP of his country. You know, like it was a disproportionate effect, and like it was too much for him to handle. And what I wanted to say about that with regard to good faith is that like a truly, truly deep person in his position might have been able to do something pretty fantastic with the powers that were granted to him. But it's too much to expect of a young person who barely even realizes that the entire world can like find all of his work. Like it's so hard. Like the thing I'm feeling about this is like, I don't know if like humankind is spiritually ready to be able to handle everything on there with good faith yet. But like, I admire the crap out of you for wanting to try. And like, while 7 million views is like probably as much attention as anybody I know has gotten for something that they just posted online, with the possible exception of a couple of people I went to high school with who are like on like, who are like famous people, the poise that you went through that whole experience with was uncommon in my experience. Like, people around me have gone viral for much less and have lost their minds about it. And like, the one time that like I was on the internet all day, that like the time that I wrote about the thing at South by Southwest, and I was on BBC World News Radio in Austin, and like all that happened, like I was so stressed out by that experience, and I thought what I was doing was in good faith too, but it took so much out of me. And like, you know, not to draw a comparison between like innocently posting a tweet and like, you know, kind of putting yourself out there as a reporter, but you were like dealing with tons of people for such a long time. And like, a lot of the replies were negative. A lot of the stuff was like probably bad faith Twitter showed up in your mentions, and you stuck it out. And like, that is what it takes to use Twitter in good faith. I want there to be a whole army of people who could handle it that way. I think that a day on Twitter would be much better for everyone on Twitter if there were many people out there that way. But I just want to point out that it's hard.
The things that are easy are the things that we'll see. And so the thing that's very easy is to respond to the things that make us anxious. Mm. You know, like the number one joke on the internet now seems to be the like, global warming can't kill me if I want to kill myself. Like, that's the like mode of humor that is sort of like the most furthest reaching right now. And I think that's because like, that is not hard. Mm-hmm. It is very easy to get into that mentality, and it is very easy to like operate from that perspective and also gain a lot of attention because of it, because people will say same
this
and, you know, respond somewhere inside of them and say like, I feel this way too. Mm-hmm. When you post something that is earnest, it almost feels awkward because being earnest does not necessarily come naturally, nor does resharing earnest things and like delighting in earnest things come naturally. And I think that sucks. Like, I just don't like that. And I take a lot of joy in sharing the things that make me feel joyful. And I know that I feel the same way when I see other people doing that same thing too. I think that the thing that this conversation has made me really recognize is that these things that I've been doing, which have felt very experimental and non-essential, are actually very important to me. And like, the way that I'm sharing these things, even though I'm sort of doing it flippantly, is a reflection of not only like the type of person I want to be online and in real life, but also the type of internet that I want to see. So I'm going to keep creating more of it.